Larry Barber presented his intellectual autobiography as the ninth talk in a series entitled Coming to Truth on March 5, 2008 at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, Jack asked me to some time ago to do this, and I've been working pretty diligently at it here, so I'd like to talk about my journey. And I'm going to talk about my journey towards goodness and truth because I kind of see them inseparable. And at least that's the way it's worked out. The first thing I want to do is I want to take about 10 minutes and I'm going to talk about a model that I use to help people understand relationships, kind of how they work, how people understand their individual patterns of interacting, kind of dynamics of relationships, and kind of what they bring to them. And I'm going to talk about that for a few minutes because I actually want to use that as a basis for and kind of run my journey through this model, in which will kind of provide a framework for that so I help you understand what I'm doing. This is a model, and I don't know if you all remember Wes talking, and he talked about the idea. Talked about the idea of having a set of lens on that affect how we see things. And this is a part of a model that I call my map, my personal map. And it actually kind of forms a grid. And it affects how I see things. And if I have a particular worldview, for example, and I interact with something out here that doesn't usually fit that worldview, then I kind of discard it. So my map acts as kind of a filter, acts as a grid that I run things through and determine whether it fits or not. One of the things that we as human beings do is we take in information. We have this ability to take in information and process it and decide whether it fits or not without even sort of thinking about it. We just do it intuitively, and that's part of what our map does. Sometimes we do it consciously and sometimes we do it unconsciously. There are two parts of our map. One is what I call the developed part and one is what I call the innate part. The developed part is life experiences, culture, worldview, and fears and beliefs. Let me talk a minute about that. Life experiences are simply everything that happens to us. It kind of goes into the computer. Whether we consciously, you know, put it in a list or note it, whether it's a good experience, a bad experience, a painful experience, all our experiences go into the map and affect us. Some of them affect us more than others. Our culture often tells us how to interpret things, how to think about our life experiences. And depending on the culture you're in, it can tell you how to interpret a life experience. One culture can tell you to interpret it very differently. But our life experiences also tell us or inform what I call our worldview. Our worldview is essentially what we think is true about the world. But it's what we think about the world outside of us. It's like what I think about the Bible and what I think is true about what the Bible says. It's who I think God is. It's why I think people do what they do. That's my worldview. Okay? That makes sense? My fears and beliefs, on the other hand, is what is it that I've come to believe is true about me from my life experiences? So it's not the world outside of me, it's the world inside of me. Sometimes our worldview and our fears and beliefs are often in conflict with each other, but we don't really necessarily know that consciously. But we live it out. We live it out as inconsistently sometimes. Okay? So that's our developed part of our map. Okay? And we carry that around with us all the time. We aren't necessarily aware of it all the time or conscious of it all the time, but it influences how we see, how we interpret what happens to us. Again, it becomes a part of the lens that we look through life with. Okay? The second part of our map is what I call the innate part. It includes imageness, which means we are created in God's image. It means there's ways in which we are like God. We are essentially spiritual beings. We have this amazing ability to process information, to take in information, to analyze it, to process it, to draw conclusions on it, and make decisions. That is an amazing, amazing thing. It's unlike any other created thing or animal. We are creative. We're relational. We're expressive. We have a will. We're emotional. Those all are part of being created in God's image. The Bible says that we, having been created in God's image, we are the best. We're His best part of His creation. But we're also broken. And we're broken in two ways. We're sinful and we're evil. Sinful simply means that there's something wrong with us. There's this disease we have of our will that kind of keeps us from doing right. It means that we're not perfect. It means that if you and I are in a relationship long enough, you and I are going to hurt each other, even if we don't want to. That's how it plays itself out. The other part that we're broken is that we're evil, and we have a harder time with that because we tend to think that people out there are evil and we're not. But the Bible is pretty clear about that. And what I think the Bible is saying about evil, or what it means, is that as a broken person, you and I have a difficult time with reality, with what God says is true. And you and I reject that as human beings, as broken human beings. We reject God's word, His truth, and we change it so to fit us, to fit what we want, to fit what we want to do. So we reject reality as God has designed it, as He created it, and He says, this is good. I think it's in Genesis 3:23, the passage says something like, and the Lord said, they become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And I think what He's saying there is that mankind has put himself in God's shoes and is deciding what is right and what is wrong for himself rather than letting God tell you or inform us about what is right and what is wrong. That is what I'm talking about is evil. Okay? So that's part of our innateness. That's part of how we're hardwired. That's part of who we are, what we bring that's what we bring to relationships. It's part of what informs how we see things. We also, as believers, have the Spirit of God, and I think the primary function of the Spirit of God is to open our eyes and to inform us what is true. And so that is the map. Let me take any quick questions about what I'm saying here, because I want to move on. Yes?
What do you mean by saying that we have the Spirit of God and that is innate?
Well, maybe that's not accurate. I think as a believer, I'm just making the point that we have the Spirit of God, and the function of the Spirit of God is to open our eyes to what's true. I don't think it's innate, but it's just, I don't know where to put it, actually.
But it's definitely not developed.
It's not developed. That's correct. Yeah. Okay. That's a good clarification. Okay. So that's the model that I want to present and just kind of have you think about as I talk about my journey, because that's what I'm going to kind of some of my experiences through and talk about. Some of the things that I'm going to talk about tonight are personal and painful. I think if my parents were here, I probably wouldn't tell you the story the way that I'm going to tell you the story or some of the same experiences. But these are experiences that have had a significant impact on my life. And number one and number two, I believe that God is ultimately the author of my story. And it's His right to write the story the way He's wanted to. And I accept that, and I actually see Him as good, and I see my story as good. So I want to say that up front. I was born in Corona, California in 1947, November 26th. That makes me 60 years old. I'm one of five children. I have an older sister, a twin brother, a younger brother, and a younger sister. And I don't really remember any discussions or talks about Christianity or God or spirituality. My mom says we used to have a birthday cake for Jesus Christmas. I have a vague memory of going to a rural country Baptist church when I was probably 10 years old. It's probably significant to me because I got stung by a bee and some guy had cigarettes and he put the tobacco on my eye, and that's what I remember. I don't remember anything else. I'm going to talk about my father for a moment because my father was a very significant man to me. My father was a career Marine Corps pilot. He did almost 32 years in the Marines. He flew fighter pilots, Corsairs. You all know what Corsairs are. Bent wing fighter pilots, fighter plane in World War II. He flew 60 combat missions in Korea in a night fighter. He was a test pilot for jets. He was the personal pilot for the Commandant of the Marine Corps. He flew helicopters, medevac, and recon in Vietnam. He did four tours of Vietnam. He was honored with numerous medals and commendations, including the Distinguished Flying Cross, which is a big deal. He is one of the most decorated Marine Corps pilots of all time. He was larger than life. He was kind of like John Wayne, or if you guys ever seen the movie The Great Santini? The difference between that character and my father is my father did not drink, but tougher. Given the fact that my father was in the Marine Corps, and we moved from one side of the United States to the other side of the United States about every 2 to 3 years, from the time I was born until I was in junior high school, the last year of my junior high school year. We ended up in Corona, California, which is where I was born, and my father was stationed at El Toro Marine Corps Base between there and his four tours of duty in Vietnam. Probably half my life, my father was gone, either flying somewhere or fighting a war. That's not a small thing. Probably up until high school, my mother was a stay-at-home mom. Then at some point, she got a job at a dentist office, and she worked there for about 20 years. As far back as I can remember, we had chores. Our house was cleaned every day. One of us vacuumed the carpets. One of us mopped the floors. One of us cleaned the bathrooms. One of us dusted all the furniture, the blinds, and the ledges. One of us set the table and did the dishes. And when my father was home, it was inspected, Marine Corps style. And believe me, you wanted to do it right. If it was not done right, or to his standard, three things would happen. First, he would be angry. Second, you would do the whole job again from top to bottom. And thirdly, it would be inspected again. If my father or mother spoke, the expected response was yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And if you happened to slip up and not respond appropriately, you got the look or you got the question, what did you say? Are you getting the feel for this? During the whole time I was growing up, every 2 weeks, my father would take my two brothers and I out into our garage or either outside, set us on a trash can, and give us a Marine Corps haircut. And in the mid-60s, this was excruciating. There was no discussion. There was no, Dad, I don't want this. I hate this. Can you look at, see everybody else's hair? Nobody else is wearing their hair like this. It was, this is what happened. I'll talk about what I learned from that in just a second here. When I was a teenager, I remember my father becoming very frustrated with me for my inquisitiveness. I asked questions. Not a lot of questions, but and not nearly the same amount of questions that my children have asked me. But at some point, out of exasperation, my father came up with a special rule for me. He instructed me that before I was going to ask a question or make a comment that I count to 10. to myself. And if after counting to 10, I believe that the question or the comment had validity or it was important, then I could make the comment or ask the question. But if it wasn't, then I should keep my mouth shut. Not long after this special rule was set in place, I remember going to the store, actually the commissary, you know what, remember that? It's the Marine Corps store. It's the military store where you buy everything. It's kind of like the Walmart, but it's nothing that size. So I went to the store with my father, and he was looking for a Christmas present from my mother, and he was looking at a set of pots and pans. And I remember being struck by how expensive they were. And I was tempted to sort of spontaneously make a comment, but I resisted the temptation. I decided, I actually remembered that this new rule, and I decided to try it out. So I counted to 10 to myself, and I thought, well, is this still important? Is this still a valid point? And I decided that it was. I said to my father, this is really expensive stuff. And my father said, you're right, it is. Oh, so I thought, this is it. I got it wired here now. This is how you please my father. You count to 10, you think about what you're going to say. If it's valid, then you can say it. If it's not, you don't. That it worked. So that was the rule that I lived by for some time. I'm making a decision here. When I was about 17 years old, I was having a discussion with my father, and I was sitting at the dining room table, and I was sitting here, and he was sitting there, and my mother walked by. And she said something, I don't remember what she said, and I kind of rolled my eyes like that at her. And my father told me to take my glasses off, and the second my glasses hit the table, I went over the back end of the chair and landed in the front room. So you get a feel for what this is about. So what was my worldview from these life experiences? I learned that it was good to follow instructions. I learned that it was good to work hard and to do a good job the first time. I learned that it was good to be respectful. I learned to do what was right and good was the way to stay out of trouble. And I learned that I was responsible for my own choices. Not bad stuff. So what were my fears and beliefs from these life experiences? I came to believe that I was responsible for how other people responded to me. I came to be afraid of making mistakes. I came to be afraid of how people might respond to me. I came to believe that I did not have a voice. I came to believe that if I kept my thoughts and feelings to myself, I was safe or safer. And I came to believe that being an observer and paying attention to people was an important key to staying out of trouble and preventing people from being angry with me. I don't know if you noticed, but there's a conflict between my worldview and my fears and beliefs. But I lived on my fears and beliefs. Now, if you were an outside observer of my family, you would most likely think that my parents raised good, honest, hardworking, respectful children. And to some extent, you'd be right. On some level, that's true. But looking back over that period of time in my life, I believe that what was most important to my parent was not raising children who valued goodness and truth for its own sake, but they valued goodness for their own sake. What was important to my parents was the desire for comfort that comes from the illusion that they were in control. They managed their environment around them, their children, for the purpose of their own comfort. If we did what they said, then life was easier. If we didn't, it was not so easy, and so it was important to them that we did what they wanted us to do. I want to skip ahead for a couple decades and tell you a story that illustrates this point. But it's sort of a family, it is a family thing, experience. In the mid-80s, my parents retired. My dad from the Marine Corps, well, and he worked for the city of Corona for a while, then my mom retired from the dentist, and then he moved to Prescott, Arizona. And while they were there, my father had a heart attack, and Christine and I were living in San Diego at the time, and we drove to Prescott to care about him and kind of support my mom. On one occasion while we were there, we were getting ready to go visit my dad at the hospital, and we were waiting for my sister's 3-4-year-old daughter to get up from a nap. And after getting up, my sister placed 2 pairs of shoes in front of her daughter. And she said, well, which of these pair of shoes do you want to wear? My niece answered that she would like to wear the pair on the left. And my sister responded to her by saying to her that she could not wear the pair on the left, she must wear the pair on the right. Now, how are you all responding to that? That's right. That's exactly right. It's kind of like, there's a clinical name for it that I won't say. But I think you know. I was sitting there and could hardly believe this, and I was taking this all in. And I very kindly and respectfully said to my sister that she ought not relate to her daughter that way because it was extremely hurtful and confusing. Confusing is a reframe. It's saying something, what I really was saying, much nicer. So my sister angrily responded to me by telling me to shut up and mind my own business. If that's all there was to it, that wouldn't be a problem. But 10 years later, I really didn't have any interaction with my sister between then and this next 10 years. We visited Prescott a second time, and we were attending my parents' 50th wedding anniversary. We walked into the house, and 2 things happened. First of all, if looks could kill, I'd be dead right there and then from the look my sister gave me. Second, my younger brother positioned himself between me and my sister the whole time that I was there to protect my sister from me. And everybody else who was in the room was aware of this except me and Christine. The most painful part of this story is that for the next 25 years, I have not been invited to a family function. Christmas, Thanksgiving, nothing. I had forgotten the family rule that you don't say anything that is perceived as negative to anyone because that could cause conflict, which is, that's the deal. We don't have conflict. And that was the whole point. And I was experiencing the consequences of breaking that rule. Part of what happened with my parents is that they were intimidated by my sister and her manipulation and emotional blackmail, and she's the victim and all that stuff, and they don't know what to do with that. You know, like, grow up. Your behavior was hurtful, you know, something like that. My parents hated the discomfort that comes from conflict. And my being present in any family function certainly would, there would be conflict, there would be tension. So I didn't get invited. And consequently, their desire for comfort and the absence of conflict trumped goodness and truth. So that illustrates what was important to my parents and my family. Okay. Upon 1960s, the lottery came into effect. You guys remember that? Remember that? I got a low number, and I was going to get drafted, and I didn't want to go into the Army and Marine Corps and get shot at or shoot people, so I joined the Navy. I was stationed on the USS Fox. It was a guided missile frigate. It was like most elite radar sonar ship in the world at the time and the fastest, one of the fastest. With a background in, I think I missed a deal here. I had gone to a community college for a year and a half between high school and college, or between high school and the Navy, and I majored in auto technology. And I'm about a semester short of an AA degree in auto technology. So with that, with that background, the Navy said, you're going to go into an engine room and work on turbines and pumps and all that kind of stuff. So that's where I ended up. I ended up in the aft engine room of a guided missile frigate. Three different steam systems, a 1,200-pound steam system, a 600-pound steam system, and a 150-pound steam system, and its average temperatures about 130 degrees. And on the coast of Vietnam, you wear pants, but you wear cut off. You soak your shirt in a bucket of ice every 10 minutes and put it back on because it's hot. And you're only moving about 10 knots, which is nothing, and the water's hot. The faster you move in a ship, the faster a ship goes, the cooler it is because there's more heat transfer. So it was hot. I was lean and mean. So I was assigned to this engine room where I spent 2.5 years deployed. Got to visit places like Japan, Thailand, Taiwan, Philippines, Bangkok. I loved traveling. I loved visiting these cultures, talking with people, playing cribbage with the Japanese people, eating their food. I had a great time. Seeing different cultures. 1 month shy of 2 years was spent in the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of Vietnam. I did 2.5 tours in Vietnam. With this work ethic that I had in hand, I was quickly promoted. I did 90% of the repair and maintenance work in the engine room. I'm 85 in 23 months and was recommended by my chief and the engineering officer to attend an officer candidate program and E6. And I also received a 7th Fleet citation. The Navy, of course, was a cakewalk because I'd already been in the Marine Corps for 18 years. I can tell you lots of stories about stuff that happened in that engine room and on that ship, but another time. In December 29th, 1969, I was home on leave at my parents' house, and my brother's wife called and then told me that my twin brother had been killed in a car accident. I was the one who had to call my father, and he came home, and we drove to my mother's place of work, and he told my mother, and a week later, I went back to the ship, and not soon after, I left for my final tour of Vietnam. As a result of my brother's death, I started thinking about life. I started thinking about the point of life and what is this all about. I began reading a Bible that my mother had given me when I went into the Navy. And as I read the Bible, I noticed that the way that it described people matched my own observations regarding people's selfishness, regarding their hurtfulness, regarding their dishonesty, regarding their desire for power and their willingness to sacrifice others' well-being for their own gain. When I read the stories in the Bible, and particularly in the Gospels, it made sense to me. I can't explain why it did. It just did. It seemed right. It seemed accurate. It seemed right on in terms of what it was describing, how it was describing people. I even saw myself in some of the pages of the Gospel. And I don't know how long ago it was. I can't remember. I know I got out in November of 1971, I think. And I think I left for Vietnam in August. And just before I left, I had gone out with this girl that my mother worked for, and she was a Christian. And I had never heard of anybody who called themselves a Christian. She was pretty open about her faith. I had gone to see her sing. She was kind of a part of a choir. She had a great voice. But she had, we had conversations, and she talked about living a life for God, and I just thought, I had never heard anybody even think about that or express, voice that kind of sentiment. And so we had lots of discussions, and it seemed really right and good that someone who, if God existed, that you ought to live your life for him because he was like the creator. That just made sense to me. So I asked her how a person could become a Christian. And I think this question really floored her because she did not expect this. And so, listen, this is really funny. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing because she went back to her car. We were sitting in a park, just talking in a park at a bench or a picnic table kind of thing, talking. And she went back to her car, got her purse out, and pulled out a 4 spiritual laws. And we went through it, and I prayed the prayer. So I don't know if that's when it happened, but that's what I did. Because I had no, I mean, this is all new to me. I had no concept of anything about any faith or anything. So I was just like, okay, this made sense to me. So I did it. After getting out of the Navy, I returned home to my parents' house, went back to the community college, met some Christians. I noticed people carrying around Bibles in a secular college. And so I said, are you, what's that? You know, and so it started a conversation about what that was. And I said, well, are you a Christian? And I said, yes. And so I started attending a Bible study. It was called the Egg Ranch Bible Study. It was in Alta Loma, California. And I did this for a couple years. And went to the Bible study, and my desire to understand the Bible continued to grow, and I wanted to know what it was saying and figure out what it was saying. And one of the leaders of the Bible study was a student at Talbot Theological Seminary, which is on the same grounds as Biola College. And I didn't know anything. I mean, I figured if you're going to go to a Bible college, you're going to learn how to study the Bible. I was really wrong. But so I enrolled at Biola, thinking that I was going to, in September of 1963, and I was thinking I was going to learn how to study the Bible, and I was going to learn all about the Bible, because it made sense to me. I'd like to tell you about, I had lots of experiences at Biola. The best experience I had at Biola is I met my wife, Christine, and I was a frequent visitor of the bookstore. I love books, and she worked there. So it was like two birds with one stone. I mean, it was good. And I got to see her and talk with her, and I got to look at books and buy books and read books. I think this is probably my third year of Biola. So I'm taking some upper division classes. I took a prison epistles class from kind of one of the most regarded Bible professors there at the time. And one of our assignments was to write a paper on Philemon. So I had taken 2 years of Greek at that point, and I would take my Greek New Testament with me to class, and I was trying to figure this all stuff out. And when I got the assignment, I was thinking, all right, we're going to do this. We're going to use our Greek, and we're going to study. And I started reading commentaries and doing some research and word studies on my own. And the more I studied and read this stuff, the more the traditional sense made less, the more the traditional perspective of Philemon made less sense to me. And I don't even know what I think about Philemon right now, but so I wrote this paper proposing an alternative view. And the way that I formatted the paper was that I presented the traditional view and I gave pros and cons for each statement or each particular piece of the text that I was looking at. And then I presented my view and I gave pros and cons for it. And then I said, I think it's this. I think it's this other view. And so I turned the paper in and I was thinking, man, this is the serious stuff. This is, we're doing this thing. And my professor shredded this thing. And he shredded it based solely on the fact that it was not the traditional view. He gave no dialogue, no reasons. He gave me a C-. And Biola, when you write papers, you put them in little notebooks. Those notebooks that have clear fronts to them? And then you have a title page, and then you have the bibliography in the back, And then you have a blank sheet of paper on the back. And that's where the professor writes his comments. And it was like full. I mean, it was bad. He shredded it. So I took the back sheet off of the paper. I took it to another professor who liked me and I liked him and I did really hard work for. And he took it and he read it. And I put another sheet on the back of it. I said, I'd like it. I didn't tell him what the other professor had done with it, but I said, would you look at this and you grade it? And he said, sure. So he did, and he gave me an A. He said, I don't know that I agree with you, but this is it. This is what you're supposed to be doing. You're thinking. You're engaged with the text. So this was the young professor who was just, he'd only taught like 3 or 4 classes at Biola. And the other guy was this guy who'd been there for 20 years, and he was the man. And so I was, this was very discouraging to me because I didn't exactly know what to do with this. Another experience was that I took another class, a Romans class, from another leading professor. And his view of Romans was very much informed by a dispensational view of reality. You all know what dispensationalism is? It's a particular theological framework that divides time into different economies or different periods of time, and that's kind of how it looks at the Bible and looks at, is that right? Yeah. And that's the perspective that Biola had, and that's how they approached Romans. So they divided Romans into justification, sanctification, glorification. And that's the framework and the lenses that they look through the book at. Okay. Well, I had a discussion with him one time, and I said, Romans is a difficult book. I don't know that I even understand what it's saying, but I don't get that at all. And I think there's this kind of thing that's going on in Romans, like there's these questions, and then there's these answer to these questions, and then there's this question that comes out of the answer, and there's another question, there's another answer, and that seems to be the structure of the book. And this was not taken well. I said, you know, I think Paul wrote the book prior to the dispensational thing. I don't think he knew about it. I might have gone too far. So he didn't appreciate that much. So what did I learn from these life experiences? What was my worldview here? I learned that not all Christians were interested in the truth of the Bible. I learned that some Christians were more committed to orthodoxy than to the truth. I learned that Christians can be very defensive about what they believed and not open to dialogue about opening alternative views. They weren't really open to thinking outside the box at all. I really wondered if there was a place to learn about how to study the Bible. I really didn't know. And it seemed to me that people were studying the Bible to be able to defend a particular theological point rather than to learn about God or understand truth. So what were my fears and beliefs from these life experiences? I was ostracized for asking questions. I mean, there's another story I could tell you about this prison epistles class that I won't, but it's the same kind of stuff. So I was ostracized by asking questions again, not unlike my father, or thinking, making comments. I believe that there must be something wrong with me for questioning the authority of these godly men, because everybody respected him. And in one class, I did question whether this passage was actually saying what the guy said it was saying, and he actually admitted it in class that it wasn't, and I was the problem. And then I didn't think I was very smart, and I was really confused about that. I didn't know if I could think, because I was being told that I was thinking wrong. So that was my fears and beliefs from those experiences. In June of 1977, I moved all my books and myself from Southern California to Palo Alto, and I attended a 2-year biblical studies program at Peninsula Bible Church. That's where I met Jack and Ron and Dick Booster and Bob Blanchard, and that was our group. Dick was afterwards, but I met these people who really wanted to study the Bible. I took 2 more years of Greek at Scribe School, attended tutorials, teaching practicums. You think teaching here or at Reformation or is tough, intimidating. You were critiqued by the tutors. You were the rest of the scribes and sometimes part of the pastoral staff, and they were there watching and listening and critiquing you as you taught. It's fun. It was a hoot. I learned principles of interpretation. I learned how to ask questions to figure the text out and what it was saying. I learned about authorial intent, like we're trying to figure out what the author's saying, not having some predisposed theological perspective before we go to it. I learned about coherence. I learned about legitimacy. While I was at scribe school, I worked with a guy named Ron Ritchie and Ted Wise. They were in charge of the singles ministry there, and I led discussion groups on the passages that were being taught, and I had some opportunities to teach at two of the different singles ministries there. But probably the most significant experience that I had there was after I graduated from scribe school, and that was I had a chance to study with Jack every Monday for 10 months, and we studied the parables of Luke. And it was there that I really put together everything that I had learned. Or not everything, but a big part of what I learned. It kind of came together, and I figured that I really developed this stuff that I was learning about how to study the Bible, and it kind of came together for me, and I learned that I could think. That was a good thing. So what was my worldview after scribe school? There were actually Christians who seemed to be interested in the truth and figuring out what the truth was, even if it was hard or uncomfortable, or even if people didn't like it. Asking questions was not a lack of faith or doubting the truth of the Bible, but a way to learn the truth of the Bible. That was a big one. What were my fears and beliefs about after scribe school? I believed that I had something valuable to say. I learned that I could study the Bible. I learned that it was okay to ask questions. And I came to believe that I could think sort of okay. In the fall of 1978, between my second and first year of scribe school, Christine and I were married. She was in Seattle. I had actually gone to Palo Alto. She had gone to Seattle. And we corresponded, and she was not going to marry me. That wasn't even an option. That wasn't even a topic of discussion. And she was afraid. And I don't know. I think it was like in the May of my first year, she called me up at 2 in the morning and told me she was in love with me. So that was all I needed. So I was already there. I was already committed. And so I think being married and having children is the place where I have seen the best and worst of me. It's the place where I've been confronted with the truth and the reality of my own brokenness and my need for mercy more than any other place. And I'm thankful for that. In April of 1980, Christine and I left the community at Peninsula Bible Church and moved to Bishop, California. Anybody know where Bishop, California is? It's due east of San Jose on the eastern side of the Sierra Nevadas, at the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas, about 5,000 feet sea level. It's a rural community where Jesus' blood is red, white, and blue, and John MacArthur sits on the left side of the throne of God. Do you know who John MacArthur is? Mm-hmm. He's a guy who many Christians, fundamentalist Christians, follow. He has a church in Panorama City. He's written many, many books particularly about Lordship salvation. And he sits on the left side of the throne of God for a lot of people. What he says is more true than what the Bible says. You want to believe that? My experience in Bishop was very rewarding and painful at the same time. And I've written about that, told stories about that, talked about it, and did a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in Bishop, and despite that church died. And even though my theology informed me that the moral playing field is always level, there's my worldview, I look back and I realize that in telling the story about Bishop and what happened in Bishop, that I always portrayed myself as the good guy, and those that made my life difficult as the bad guys. It's striking how I could believe such good theology and yet apply it so badly when it came to my own life. About 18 years after we visited, or after I left Bishop, we went back there. We camped, fished, spent time with some friends. My oldest son, Jesse, had a chance to see where he was born. And there's this interesting experience I had. I was literally walking between the laundromat and the grocery store. And my theology and my bias storytelling collided, literally while I was walking between the laundromat and the grocery store. I realized that I had deceived myself into thinking and believing that I was somehow morally different from the people who had hurt me. I had compared my good theology and my best efforts with their hurtful behavior, and I concluded that I was the good guy in my story, and those people who had hurt me were the bad guys. And my colored storytelling served as a strategy for self-protection. It allowed me to hold on to the belief, the false belief, that I was right and they were wrong and I was different from them. What did I learn from that? Most importantly, I realized that in a way that I had not realized before, that without God's intervention, without God giving me eyes to see, that I was blind to myself and to the truth about myself. That I needed God to give me eyes to see, that I needed mercy as much as anyone else did. I also learned that just because people go to church and profess faith does not mean they're interested in truth. I learned that some people respond to the truth positively and some won't. I learned that people often use others as scapegoats in order to not deal honestly with themselves. I also learned that just because someone asks you a question and they want you to tell them what's true doesn't mean they're really interested in what's true. That was like a shocker for me. I can remember the moment I saw that. I'm going, wow. I mean, somebody asked me a question about what I thought about their behavior in a meeting. And they actually said, "Did you think I was hurtful?" And I said, "Yes." And they did not want to know the answer. But I don't know that it was a mistake to give them the answer, but I did. But I learned that just because somebody asked a question doesn't mean they want to know the answer. We left Bishop after 3 years, and I went back to Biola, finished my degree in biblical studies, and did some more undergraduate work in psychology. One of the things that happened in Bishop is that Christine was a counselor there, and I started doing a lot more counseling as a pastor, and felt very inadequate and wanted to have a better idea of what I was doing. So I started meeting. They had educational staff meetings every 2 weeks. Christine worked for County Mental Health and was in charge of the alcohol diversion stuff program, and she was part of the mental health program in Inyo County. So I started meeting with them and just learning more about how to help people. And so I became more and more interested in counseling, and I decided if people come for counseling, maybe they really want to know the truth. There's a better chance of that than just regular people in a church. I don't know, that was my fantasy at the time, but that's what I thought. And so I left Bishop. Finished my undergraduate work, picked up another degree in psychology, and began a 2 years Master's of Arts program in counseling psychology in San Diego. I did an internship. When you're doing a master's work, you're required to have certain 3,000 hours of supervised counseling face-to-face, and you have to do an internship where you accrue those hours. And I worked at College Avenue Baptist Church in San Diego and received my supervision. I had an important an invaluable, painful experience there. I'd been working there for, I've been there about a year, I guess, and I've been working with a couple for about 3 months, and I like working with them, and they seemed to like me, and I think they were happy with how I was helping them. But I was talking to my supervisor about my work with them, and I came to the realization that my wanting them to like me had gotten in the way of my actually being helpful to them. There were some significant issues that were there for them that I had not brought to their attention, that I ignored. I don't think consciously, but it still was there. I should have seen it. And I realized that it was because I wanted them to like me. I was afraid that they might be angry with me. So we're going back to my fear about people being angry with me and wanting people to like me, because I learned to be afraid. So my fear of having someone angry with me not only got in the way of me being helpful, but it hurt the relationship. It was not authentic. It was not genuine. And I had made a commitment to be helpful, and I was not. Now, this may not sound like a big deal to you, but it was huge to me, because I had moved my family twice. I moved from Bishop to Los Angeles, and then from Los Angeles to San Diego. We just had our second child, boy, and I was most of the way through a second-year master's degree, and I was seriously questioning whether it would be right or good or moral for me to be a counselor. And I struggled with this dilemma for some time and had several extended conversations with my supervisor. And at one point, he asked me a very helpful question. And here's the question. I'm going to read it because I don't want to, I want to get it right. Bill told me not to mess up. So what do you think would be good? To not be aware of your fears and continue being a counselor, and have your fears be the agenda that plays itself out in the relationship with your clients? Or do you think it would be good to be aware that you have fears, be committed to learn from them and work with them as you continue being a counselor? That's the question. That's the question that he asked. But my supervised question really helped me understand the more important and underlying issue. Was I willing to see and work with the truth about myself as I became aware of it? And secondly, was I okay with people being angry with me if in trying to help them, I said something they didn't like? Was I willing to try to be caring and truthful with people even if they didn't like me? Was I choosing the truth and goodness over comfort, which is what my family taught me to do? Did I value the truth more than comfort? That was a big thing. And then I struggled with that for a while. This was a pivotal experience for me. And over the years, I've come to value the truth more and more as I have relationships with people and try to help them. And unlike the comfort-seeking my family upheld, I've come to value the process of interacting with truth, whether it be the truth about me or my own brokenness or my need for mercy, or whether it's the truth that a friend or a client may be blind to in their life. I've become more and more committed to the truth that goodness and truth trumps comfort. What did I learn from that experience? I learned that trying to be helpful to others, I can be hurtful even when I'm trying. Even when I'm committed to being helpful, I can still be hurtful. That sin is a bigger problem than my wanting something. In April of 1989, Christine and I moved to Eugene with our three children. We moved here specifically because we wanted to be around people who took the Bible seriously and who were interested in the process of coming to truth. And we wanted to be Christian counselors, not just in name, but in truth. I've been exposed to good teaching. I've read amazing books and authors that I'd never heard of before who communicate ideas that stretch my mind. I've been part of discussions with people around here that have helped me think about things in a very different way. I've come to understand faith in a way that I hadn't before, at what it is and what it isn't. And that was very helpful. I've studied the Bible, and I've come to see that the Bible tells the story of my need for mercy and the value of goodness. And I've come to value that more and more and more. So that's my journey. That's where I'm at today. So, any questions? The mic is right here. Wow. Yes. You have to turn it on, I think.
Is that right? Okay. I was a little curious about your falling out with your family.
Yes.
And I know it's kind of a sensitive topic, but if you want to talk at least in general terms about why it was that that your family felt that you were a threat, or your sister in particular felt that you were a threat, because it seemed like you said that she was afraid of you, or you were being protected from her, or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I think I was a threat because I actually said something. I mean, literally, there was a rule. I mean, that you didn't make people uncomfortable. You didn't say anything that was negative that somebody would be uncomfortable, because that would create conflict. I mean, to give you another side of it, my mother apologized to me 3-4 months ago for the first time in her life. My father never, ever apologized to me for anything. So I think for I think my sister saw me as being very, very hurtful to her. I think that's the kind of the story she told herself, and that I wasn't safe. And I think I represented to her somebody who was going to say stuff that was hurtful to her. I mean, I think that's how she sees it. Is that?
Yeah, and the rest of your family kind of took her view.
My sister. My sister is 54, and she talks like a baby. So she literally sees herself as a victim and presents herself as a victim. And I think that, I mean, so she comes off as very fragile. And I think my parents have no idea what to do with that. And my older sister and my brother, younger brother, kind of go to her rescue. I think that's, I can't speak to why they do that. My older sister kind of thinks she knows everything about everything. So she wants to be the answer man or the important person in her life. But I don't know. I could tell you some other stories about all that, but I think the reason that I wasn't invited, because if I was there, then there would be tension, there would be conflict, and something could happen. And so I just wasn't invited. And I mean, my father passed away here in last April, and my mother asked me to speak at his memorial service and his graveside service. And I think when my children came and we were there, it was all the cousins and all the siblings, all they were over here and we were over here. I mean, they weren't associating with us. And it was very clear, but it was very awkward. And I think my siblings very much resented my mother asking me to speak, because I was like the outsider for 25 years. And now my mother's here in Eugene, and I'm caring about her, and they don't like that either. So.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Thank you.
Sure. It's pretty painful, actually very painful.
A couple things I was I heard and was interested to see if you could talk more. I don't know if I have a question.
Sure.
There was the one time between the laundromat and the
yes.
grocery store.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk more about how you handled that situation. Also, like when you were considering whether to be a counselor or not,
right.
how you handled that.
Those are similar experiences.
And also in your marriage, when it taught you not only the worst of you, but also brought out the best of you. I wonder if you could talk some about that. And
well,
like how you handled. What's that?
Were you here last week when Christine talked?
Yes, that was.
Okay. Well, you don't want a lot. I know why I like you, Jack. I think part of what happened in Bishop when we were visiting there was just the anxiety of being there. I mean, I physically felt anxious being there, just from remembering what happened there and how painful it was. And it just kind of was there in my mind. So I think that's part of it. I remember talking with Christine and crying and being sad. And I mean, I don't know. I can't explain how what happened between the laundromat and the... But I just remember thinking how wrong I was, or how wrong I was about that. About I was the good guy and they were the bad guy. That I played a part in this. And I was being a bad guy telling the story the way that I mean, I wasn't, I hate to use that term, bad guy, but I was not being truthful with myself about what was true, about what the Bible was saying. And part of it was just coming to thinking about what my worldview was and then realizing what I was believing, that there was a conflict there. So I think it was seeing the conflict, and I think part of the just being there brought out that all up to in my mind. That makes sense. I think in terms of the counseling thing, I had a wonderful supervisor, clinical supervisor, who pretty much a lot of your supervision today is just teaching you techniques, teaching you how to stay out of trouble, essentially, legally. And, I mean, they're required to do some of that, but what he did basically was ask me questions like, well, don't misunderstand how I'm saying this. He would say, well, why did you do that? What did you want from that? And so he was basically helping me understand myself. And it was that kind of dialogue that went on that helped me see I was wanting to be honest with myself about what was going on and why I wanted why I did what I did or why I didn't do what I wanted, what did I want. That started the kind of the process of helping me see I was afraid. And there was this issue that, I mean, it was clear. He asked this question, and I mean, I can't even tell you what the question was, but, well, is this true, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, or have they talked about this, or have you brought this up, or, and it was like, oh, way duh. And I thought, why didn't I do that? What did I want? So that's kind of how that happened. So I had a wonderful supervisor who, that's essentially what he did, which was very, very helpful. Because I think, besides having a worldview that's accurate and that understands human beings from a true perspective, a biblical perspective, I think what makes a counselor a good counselor is their willingness to work with themselves and be honest with themselves. And because if you're not, then it's your thing that's being played out in the room rather than being helpful. And it gets in the way. I think that's what makes a good counselor a good counselor. What was your last question?
About your marriage.
And what do you want to know about that?
You say, well, you said, I mean, I'm familiar with everybody saying how marriage brings out the worst in you.
Oh, okay.
But you also said that it brought out the best in you.
That's right. Well, let me. Okay. Well, let me say something before that and then get to that. Um, unlike our culture, where I think in our culture the purpose of marriage is happiness, I think God has a very different agenda for marriage, and his agenda is that I come to terms with my own brokenness and my need for mercy and value goodness, and that I see myself as my own problem, not somebody else. Okay, that's what I think marriage is about. I think what happens in our culture is that we point the finger and we think the other person's the problem, and that's why there's so many divorces. And I think that's what happens in divorce, is that. And I think this is the worst problem in marriage, is that. Okay? The finger. I mean, pointing the finger at the other person, thinking they're the problem. Okay. So I want you to be clear that I think I'm my own worst problem here. And living with me is tough. And living with Christine is tough. And she talked about that a little bit last week. And so I think there have been moments where Christine has been very difficult, and I've actually loved her. And that's the part that's the best. I think there's also times where I've been horrible and she's loved me. That's the best. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think a lot of times I guess in the communities that I've run in, you hear a lot about how it brings out the worst and not so much about how it brings out the best in you.
I think whenever you put people in close proximity, you know, it's going to fly.
That's probably true.
You spoke to the difficulty of seeing truth and then identifying it, and how others don't necessarily want to hear mm-hmm. what is true. And then in your field, where you have maybe a more insight to the human condition, and how did you learn, say, outside of the, you know, counseling session room with people in your community, to gauge the appropriateness of identifying said difficult truth, mm-hmm. and at what point, you know, what is being loving,
yes.
and at what point you call someone out on something, right. hold them accountable, and what right. point you go, well, they have to sort this one out themselves.
Okay. Well, I don't know how I do it outside the, I mean, I just live life, and but part of what happens in counseling is there's this, I mean, there's kind of a presupposition that people are actually coming for help. And a lot of times they just don't see it. They don't see what's right in front of them about themselves or about what's going on in a relationship. And they need help seeing it. And so the more I've done this, and I've been doing this now for about 25 years, really it's a lot of, I really see the value of that, of telling people the truth more and more and more, because we just need it, because we're blind without it. So it's not an issue of whether or not to do it. It's figuring out how. And part of what the art of counseling, part of it, is figuring out how people can hear, and what they can hear, and how to say it in a way that they can hear it, without offending them or, I don't care about it, not so much about offending them, I guess, without, I mean, people have been offended, for sure. Just trying to communicate in a way that they can hear it. And you have to listen to people and understand their framework and understand, kind of see where they're coming from and kind of join them a bit and find a way to say it, I guess. I think I have to say it. I'm committed to saying it.
But do you find that in your outside relationships, you know, if they're not necessarily asking you, I mean, when they come to you in counseling, presumption.
Well, see, the thing with my sister that I told you about, I was this like new therapist, you know. And I wasn't very wise. I think it was true. It's nuts. It was crazy making, right? And I mean, at the time, I thought it was the right thing to do. I mean, it may not have been, but...
Because she certainly didn't hear you.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. But see, that's not how I gauge whether I say something or not either, whether somebody hears it. It's just, it's really a commitment to try to be helpful, to try to have a relationship with them in a way that's actually redemptive or helpful to them. And I mean, all I can do is do the best I can. Am I getting at what you're asking?
I guess so. But just knowing whether or not it's your place in a relationship.
I really work at not doing therapy outside the room.
Yeah.
I think it's, I don't want to do it. Therapy is hard. Counseling is hard work.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, like when I first started being a counselor, I was like on all the time.
Yeah.
Even outside the room. That is just like,
no, see, that's I guess what I'm getting at is whether or not you shut it off.
I do. I'm tired.
Because I think there are those of us who wander about thinking we're perceptive of other people and their situation and go, I've got something that might be beneficial, and maybe I should count to 10.
Yeah.
I had an experience
where I was with I was actually with Earl down in Southern California. And we went to some meeting, and I was just there visiting Earl. I was up from San Diego visiting Earl. And this guy went completely ballistic in this meeting, thinking that I was looking at him and watching him and kind of cracking his head open and analyzing him. And I told him, I said, well, I'm sorry. I wasn't thinking about you at all. I mean, but I wasn't. So I just don't want to do that. I think it's people aren't asking you for it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you and I were really good friends and I saw you being hurtful out of the friendship, out of the relationship, if I had a relationship with you, I'd tell you that I thought you were being hurtful. Mm-hmm. But if I didn't have a relationship, it really has to depend on the relationship, I think, determines that. But I'm off when I walk out that door of the room.
Yeah.
No more. Yeah. It's enough hard work to live life.
Sure.
Yeah.
Can you talk some about goodness? Because I feel like I've heard a little more. Well, you started by saying that you saw goodness and truth.
Yes, related.
Being so related, mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to hear sort of your journey in truth. Do you mean in goodness? You gave a lot of examples where you had to sort of reckon with yourself and how you dealt with yourself or with people. Is that what you're meaning by goodness or other things?
That's what I mean.
Okay.
Goodness, I mean acting in a way that's committed to someone's best interest. Being loving. And certainly part of the journey has been to discover through failure, I've learned my need for mercy and the value of goodness, but I continually fail. So that's part of the process. Is that? Yes. Yeah. Yes?
This is more a comment than a question. I have been struck by both yours and Christine's openness about who you are and where you've, the bleeding edge where you've learned about life and your willingness to share that. And that kind of vulnerability is a wonderful thing. I have profited a lot from that, from both of you. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. I had something in my mind and it went away. I did. I just remembered what I was going to say, and then I'll get, which answers your question more. When I started tonight, I talked about probably if my mother was here, I wouldn't be telling the same story. I think my mother would be very hurt by what I said tonight. And she wouldn't. She would feel bad that I hurt. It would be distressing to her to think that I was hurt so much by my father. I'm not going to tell her this story, even though it's true, because it just would be too hurtful to her, and it wouldn't be helpful to her. What I do with my mother, though, is when there are moments where, and for a while I haven't had a relationship with my mother, and I'm beginning to have more of a relationship with her, but what I'm trying to do with her is, as she interacts with me, I try to care about her and help her see things from a different perspective or that kind of stuff. But I would not tell her this story.
Because I guess the natural reaction would be to let her know.
And I don't want any of you to tell her this story either. It's not your story to tell. Okay?
Yeah. But then
well, you should hear what your son said. You know, that would not be okay with me.
Satisfaction that you might get from finally letting that they need to know.
But it's not about them.
But it's not about them.
It's about me. What I do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's God's story.
Yeah.
God's writing the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm good with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
you tell him how hurtful.
I struggle with it. I've struggled with it. One of the things that I think I had a conversation with Jack a few months ago, was just God has a right to write this story. It's hard, you know. That hurts. And it's something you kind of come to it and you, okay. But then it comes up again. And yeah.
I'm just curious, your mother gave you a Bible when you went into the Navy. But you didn't remember any Christianity in your background?
No, there was this Bible that was actually out of olive wood that was from Israel. I don't know where she got it. I don't even know where it is now. But, I mean, I think it's in a box someplace. But she gave it to me and just wanted as a gift to go when I went in the Navy because I was leaving. But no discussions. I mean, I don't remember anything at all. And I think my mother has faith now. I think part of her getting older and coming to terms with her own mortality and seeing people be hurtful and stuff like that. I think she's thought more about that. But I don't know about my dad. I don't know. But none of my siblings are believers at all. My older sister claims to be a Buddhist who, it's weird stuff. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.